ticket, but if at 6:30 didn't shown here, that means the other people can get in.
The scene was calm but intense outside Andela Cafe in Central Square on Thursday, September 5th, 2014, as hundreds gathered trying to get the limited amount of tickets available for a unique event. Professor Noam Chomsky was to give one of his critiques on the current situation in Gaza. It is not unusual for Noam to publicly address this issue. What was unusual is that instead of a large lecture hall, he was doing it in a small cafe. The response was almost overwhelming. Andela Cafe is owned by a Palestinian family. Rihanna, a member of the cafe, hosted the event. She laid out the ground rules and purpose for having Noam Chomsky in this setting.
We are hoping to do something very different this evening. I'm sure many of you have heard Professor Chomsky in the capacity of institutions and at MIT, at Harvard, at other halls. But here we're hosting this at a cafe. A few of us sat together one evening and we thought, how nice would it be to revive cafe politics? Right? Let's do a revival of cafe politics in Cambridge, and let's do what we used to do back in the 60s and get people off the street, people in the community coming in, getting involved, because it's people like you and I. It's ordinary people. It's not the people at the top. So if we can tonight go away from here understanding the issue and being inspired to do something, then I think that we've done something very special. And without any further delay, I will pass the mic over to Professor Chomsky.
Well, as you are all aware, there was a ceasefire reached about a week ago, August 26th. The question on everyone's mind is, what's next? And there are two factors to look at in trying to reach an answer to that question. One is, what has the history been of preceding ceasefire agreements? There's been a series of them for roughly a decade. So what's the history? What's the pattern? The second question is, what's the nature of the existing circumstances? Have they changed in any significant way, which might lead to an expectation and the change of the pattern? So let me say a couple of words about each of those. First, briefly running through the history. Actually, there is a fixed pattern. It recurs over and over again. The terms of the ceasefire agreements for roughly a decade have been approximately the same, and the aftermath has been pretty much the same as well. Israel ignores the terms and continues as before. Hamas has abided by the terms, as Israel officially concedes, and continues to until some escalation of Israeli repression and violence elicits a Hamas response, at which point there is an Israeli reaction, an episode that in Israeli parlance is called mowing the lawn, brutal attack on Gaza. It's basically shooting fish in a pond. A high-level U.S. official, military official recently, who was observing Israel's tactics in the latest episode of mowing the lawn, the fiercest so far, said it shouldn't be called mowing the lawn, it should be called removing the topsoil. He was appalled, as many others have been, by the savagery of the tactics that are used against a defenseless civilian population. That's been the regular pattern. It begins in November 2005, and instead of reading it from, giving it from memory, I'll give you the actual terms of the agreement that was reached in November 2005. That was the agreement on movement and access, November 2005. It called for a crossing between Gaza and Egypt at Rafah for the export of goods and the transit of people, continuous operation of crossings between Israel and Gaza for the import and export of goods and the transit of people, reduction of obstacles to movement within the West Bank, bus and truck convoys between the West Bank and Gaza, the building of a seaport in Gaza, a reopening of the airport in Gaza, a reopening because there was an airport. In fact, when Arafat arrived in 93, he arrived by plane, but Israeli bombing had destroyed it along with much else. Well, you know what's happened over the years and how well those terms have been observed. But what happened right away? Remember the timing. This was weeks after Israel's well-publicized disengagement from Gaza, in which several thousand settlers who had taken large part of the arable land and limited water supplies and were protected by a huge segment of the Israeli army, they were removed from their illegal settlements in Gaza and transferred over to illegal settlements in the West Bank and the Golan Heights areas that Israel intended to keep. Israeli hawks understood that didn't make much sense to maintain this presence and huge expense in Gaza, which was already devastated, so they would prefer to develop the areas they intended to keep in any future settlement. It was portrayed as a noble gesture for peace. And you may recall a big propaganda campaign. Those of you who are in Boston would have seen big photographs, front page photographs in the Boston Globe of a little child pleading with the Israeli soldiers not to tear down his home, with a headline saying, "Never again," and so on and so forth. It was all a very well-orchestrated farce. It was perfectly clear that if Israel could have easily withdrawn with no publicity at all, it was all that's necessary, and this has lessons for the West Bank. All that would have been necessary would have been for Israel to announce that on August 1st, the Israeli army would leave Gaza, at which point the settlers would leave their subsidized homes in Gaza, climb into the trucks that are buses that are ready for them, and move on to subsidized illegal homes in the West Bank. But there wouldn't have been any trauma, no photographs on the front page of the Boston Globe, and no message, "Never again," which means no more uprooting of settlements. That would have been lost. What made the farce particularly obvious was that it was a repetition of what was called in Israel National Trauma 1982. When Israel was forced to leave the Sinai, they also staged a trauma in much the same way and with the same purpose. And in fact, intelligent Israelis, like the leading Israeli sociologist Baruch Kimmerling, simply ridiculed the whole operation, as did others. But it was effective from a propaganda point of view, very effective here, which is where it was intended. Well, that was the disengagement. And what actually happened afterwards is described lucidly by two Israeli scholars, the leading scholars who have written on the history of the settlement, Idit Zertal and Akiva Eldar, a book called Lords of the Land, the major study of the settlement history. What they say is that the ruined territory of Gaza was not released for even a single day from Israel's military grip or from the price of the occupation that the inhabitants pay every day. Israel left behind scorched earth, devastated services, people with neither a present nor a future. The settlements were destroyed in an ungenerous move by an unenlightened occupier, which in fact continues to control the territory and kill and harass its inhabitants by means of its formidable military might, which is what happened then and has been continuing. The motive for the disengagement. For the public, it was a gesture for peace. Internally, it was explained very explicitly, very clearly, by the most important figure, the man who was in charge of negotiating the withdrawal with the United States, not with the Palestinians, negotiating the withdrawal and implementing it. The vice glass, he was a close confidant of Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. And he explained to the press what it was about. I'll read. The significance of the disengagement plan is the freezing of the peace process. And when you freeze that process, you prevent the establishment of a Palestinian state, and you prevent a discussion on the refugees, discussion of the borders and of Jerusalem. Effectively, this whole package called the Palestinian state, with all that that entails, has been removed indefinitely from our agenda. And all of this with authority and permission, he's referring to the United States, all with a U.S. presidential blessing and the ratification of both houses of Congress. The disengagement is actually formaldehyde. It supplies the amount of formaldehyde that is necessary so that there will not be a political process with the Palestinians. That's, if there's time, we can go into it, but that's a continuation of Israeli policies that go back officially since 1971, blocking of the political process while expansion continues into Palestinian areas. That's the internal description. The public description was noble gesture for peace, which the Palestinians refused. You know the story. Well, that was November 2005. A few months later, an opportunity arose for Israel and the United States. They work in tandem, and that's critically important. Israel and the United States had an opportunity to sharply escalate the attack against Gazans, which Zertel and Eldar described in the way I just read. What happened was that Palestinians committed a major crime. There was a free election, carefully monitored, and they voted the wrong way. That's impermissible. When the United States talks about democracy promotion and your representatives and, you know, the journalists and commentators talk about the wonders of democracy promotion, what they mean is it's fine as long as you vote the right way. If you don't, something else happens. And what happened in this case is they voted the wrong way. They handed the parliament over to Hamas. Carefully monitored free election, the first one of that kind in the Arab world. That's when there was all sorts of talk about the importance of promoting democracy among the backward Arabs. Israel and the U.S. immediately imposed harsh sanctions to punish the Palestinians. The European Union, to its shame, timidly went along, as it usually does. Israel stepped up its military attacks. In fact, by June, about 7,700 Israeli 150-millimeter shells had fallen on Gaza. There was quite a harsh period of attack. I mentioned June because in June the attacks escalated very sharply, ways that we could describe. Well, that's what happened to the first of the ceasefire agreements. So matters continued with repeated Israeli assaults until about a year later, mid-2007, when Palestinians committed an even greater crime, very serious one. In January 2006, when the election took place, when it came out the wrong way, the United States immediately put into motion a standard operating procedure, organize a military coup to overthrow the unacceptable elected government. And it was in cooperation with elements of the Palestinian Authority. Mohammed Dahlan was supposed to be the leader, Fatah, strongman. Hamas got word of it, preempted the coup, and maintained its own political structure, elected structure, and power. That's a really serious crime. It's bad enough to vote the wrong way in a free election, but to block a U.S.-run military coup to overthrow the elected government, that's a major crime. And in fact, the attacks on Gaza escalated very sharply after that. When you read about it today in the press and commentary, it's called Hamas taking over Gaza and kicking out the Palestinian Authority, which is not totally false, but omitting a few crucial facts, which are not incidentally in doubt. They're well documented. That's when the attacks became very strong, continued that way until June 2008, when another ceasefire agreement was reached. I won't read the terms. They were about the same as the November 2005. End hostilities, open borders, export and import, transit between West Bank and Gaza, and so on. That met the standard pattern perfectly. Hamas lived up to the agreement 100%. No Hamas rockets, zero. You can read it in the official Israeli internal documents, intelligence documents. And it lasted that way. Israel didn't observe the terms. They said that they would not leave the siege. They would maintain it. The pretext was that Hamas had captured an Israeli soldier, a soldier of an attacking army, Gilad Shalit. That's not much of a crime. And until he was released, Israel would refuse to obey the terms of the ceasefire that it had accepted. Israel, incidentally, kidnaps people in Lebanon and the high seas, constantly inside the territories it controls, holds them for long periods, sometimes decades, without charges, sometimes as hostages. But that arouses no interest or concern. It's a distinction that George Orwell made very clearly. He distinguished what he called people from unpeople. Unpeople are those who are undeserving. They don't have rights. They're in the way of the powerful. So Palestinians are unpeople, and Lebanese are unpeople. When they get kidnapped, imprisoned, nobody. Sometimes you get a mention in the 18th paragraph of a story in the New York Times, but that's about it. Israel, it's different. In any event, Israel refused to accept the terms of the June 2008 ceasefire. Hamas did accept them and adhere to them until November 4th. On November 4th, which was the day of the U.S. election, and media attention was focused on that, the Israeli army invaded Gaza, killed half a dozen Hamas militants. There was then a Hamas reaction, interchange of rockets, went on for a number of months. A lot of people were killed, all Palestinians as usual. In late December, Hamas offered to renew the ceasefire, December 2008 now. It was considered by the Israeli cabinet. They rejected it. Instead, they chose to launch Operation Cast Lead, three-week invasion of Gaza, by far the most destructive yet, well documented in international and, in fact, Israeli human rights reports. I'm sure you're all familiar with it. In the course of Operation Cast Lead, January 9th, the UN Security Council met. It had tried to pass resolutions calling for a ceasefire, but the U.S. had blocked it, as happens consistently for decades. However, they did pass a resolution, another ceasefire agreement, very similar to the earlier ones. So I won't repeat the terms, slight differences, but basically the same. And the aftermath was similar. The terms of the ceasefire were never... incidentally, the Israeli attack on Gaza was... Israel can control what's happening militarily as precisely as it likes. It has all the power. And the timing of the cast lead was very precisely designed for the purposes of protecting the incoming president, President Obama. As long as the attack was going on, when Obama was asked to make a comment on it, he said, "I'm sorry, I can't. We have only one president, and that president has to speak." He was speaking about everything else, but not that. In fact, he did make some comments about it. He said that if my daughters were being attacked by rockets, I would do anything possible to stop them. He was talking about Sderot in Israel, not what was happening in Gaza, which was being devastated. The operation was timed so that it ended immediately before the inauguration. Okay, at that point, there was no longer any excuse. We have only one president, but the operation had stopped. So Obama could move into the other mode, saying, let's not talk about the past, let's talk about the future, and the future will be wonderful, and so on. That's a marvelous line for those who are committed to criminal operations. If you've decided on a life of crime, remember that if you're caught, you should say, let's forget about the past and talk about how great everything's going to be from now on. That's standard great power rhetoric. But the agreement had been reached, and the terms were, of course, never met. There was and so it went and continued until November 2012, when there was another episode of mowing the lawn. This was, just to give you an idea of what was going on at the time, in the year 2012, from January up to November, when the operation, Pillars of Cloud, it was called this time, when that operation began, 78 Palestinians had been killed. One Israeli had been killed, usual ratio. The operation began in November with the assassination of a man named Ahmad Jibril. He was described by the editor of Israel's leading newspaper, Haaretz, Aleph Ben, as being Israel's subcontractor in Gaza, the person who kept, he was a Hamas official. He was helping keep things quiet, making sure things worked the way Israel wanted. So why was he assassinated? Well, the probable answer was given by an Israeli peace activist, Gershon Baskin, who informed the press that he had been in negotiations with Jibril for some time, and hours before the assassination, Jibril had been handed a statement from Egypt and Palestinian Authority for offering a full peace treaty, and then he was assassinated immediately. It's a plausible surmise that that was the reason for the assassination. As I mentioned, Israel's been dedicated for a long time to preventing any diplomatic settlement for good reasons. A diplomatic settlement means you have to stop the programs of expansion and takeover of territory, elimination of Palestinians, and so on. Well, that's 2012, November 2012. There was, again, after that episode of mowing the lawn, there was another ceasefire agreement. I will quote from an expert on what happened afterwards, Nathan Thrall. He's the chief Middle East analyst, highly respected Middle East analyst for the International Crisis Group. What he writes is that Israeli intelligence recognized that, once again, Hamas was living up to the ceasefire agreements, and Israel, I'm quoting him, therefore saw little incentive in upholding its end of the deal. In the 3 months following the ceasefire, its forces made regular incursions into Gaza, strafed Palestinian farmers and those collecting scrap and rubble across the border, fired boats, prevented fishermen from accessing the majority of Gaza's waters. The siege never ended. Crossings were repeatedly shut, so-called buffer zones inside Gaza. These are large zones inside Gaza, which take up about a third of Gaza's arable land. Gazans can't go into them. They get immediately killed if they go into them. Pretext to security, as always. Buffer zones were reestablished and reinstated. Imports declined. Exports were blocked. And fewer Gazans were given exit permits to Israel in the West Bank. That was the latest ceasefire. That one continued until June of this year in the usual pattern. Hamas observed it completely. Israeli high officials point out that there were no Hamas rockets. Israel, of course, didn't live up to any of the terms that were reached, and maintained its regular attacks for the reasons that Thrall describes. In April of this year, a very important event took place. The unity government was established between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Israel has been trying to block that for years. Israel was utterly infuriated. There's good reason for that, which I'll come back to. It was a pretty remarkable agreement. Those of you who followed it should be aware of this. Hamas gave up everything. The unity government had no Hamas members. The Palestinian Authority, Fatah, that means, was permitted to send thousands of troops into Gaza for security and also to control all the borders and crossings. No reciprocal rights for Hamas in the West Bank. And furthermore, and governance of Gaza was shifting into the hands of Fatah, the Hamas's enemy. And furthermore, the unity government accepted all of the official demands of the so-called quartet, United States, European Union, the United Nations, and Russia, commitment to nonviolence, acceptance of past agreements, and recognition of Israel. They accepted all of it, not a word of protest from Hamas. Hamas itself doesn't accept it, but they were willing to be part of that government. Israel was very angry at that, and it got even more infuriated when not only Europe, but even the United States indicated approval for it. That was really dangerous. At that point, Israel launched a major rampage in the West Bank and Gaza, had a pretext as always. The pretext was the murder of three teenage boys from one of the settler communities, brutal murder. The Israeli government claimed that they didn't know whether they'd been killed or not, so they had a long search, which is a rampage. It turns out they knew right away that they were dead. They claimed right away that this was a Hamas operation. Israel's own specialists, like Shlomi Eldar, one of their main specialists, said that this is highly unlikely, and he almost immediately wrote that in an Israeli journal that the perpetrators were almost certainly from a clan in Hebron that has been a thorn in the side of Hamas for years. The Kawasme clan itself harshly repressed, but carrying out operations that Hamas didn't like and didn't authorize. And by now that's been pretty much conceded. In fact, in today's New York Times, there's an article which you can read which obliquely discusses the documents that Israeli intelligence has released and points out, you know, that's pretty much what they say. There's no indication that the Hamas leadership had anything to do with it or even knew about it, which was pretty evident from the start. But it did give an opportunity for a major assault. Hundreds of people were arrested, many imprisoned, tortured, and many killed. A huge amount of property was stolen and so on, mostly targeting Hamas. And there were also attacks in Gaza. On July 7th, half a dozen or so Hamas activists were killed by Israel in Gaza, and the next day there was finally a Hamas reaction, first time in 18 months. And then came Operation Protective Edge, the latest episode which we've just seen and you know about, which is the fiercest of all. That's been the pattern right through since the first of these operations, immediately after the disengagement, which was undertaken for the reasons I mentioned. Will it continue? Well, that depends on, to think through that question, we have to ask about the reasons and the circumstances. Now, the reasons are pretty straightforward. There's a very simple rationale for Israel's consistent policy, supported by the United States, to separate Gaza from the West Bank. In fact, that policy has been underway since the early 1990s. In 1993, Israel and the Palestinian Authority, as you know, signed the Oslo Accords with President Clinton standing on the White House lawn, all seen the picture. A day of awe, it was called in the Boston Globe. Anyone who read the terms of that accord knew that this is going to be a disaster. Well, it's a take a look sometime at the Declaration of Principles that was signed. I must say, I wrote about it right away, talked about it right away. It was perfectly obvious. The Declaration of Principles that was signed says that the ultimate goal of the negotiations, the final goal, will be observance of United Nations Resolution 242. Now, anyone who knows the diplomacy of the period knows that that resolution does not mention Palestinian rights. It says, you know, there's some phrase about nice treatment of the refugees, but that's it, no Palestinian rights. But that was to be the ultimate goal, total disaster for the Palestinians. Interesting questions why Arafat and the developing Palestinian Authority accepted this, could go into it, but they did. It basically undermined internal Palestinians who refused to accept it. There had been a Palestinian negotiating team led by Haider al-Shafi, probably the most respected Palestinian in the territories, a dedicated nationalist, and he refused to sign any of the agreements that Bush and Baker and Rabin and others were pressing unless they ended settlement expansion. Arafat was willing to give that up, and he was willing to give up all Palestinian goals, as the declaration made clear. So that was the day of awe. Haider al-Shafi refused even to attend the ceremony on the White House lawn, quite properly. But many of you will remember the hype about that. The agreement, the Oslo Accords, did state that the West Bank and Gaza are an indivisible territorial entity which cannot be separated. From that point on, the United States and Israel have been dedicated to separating them, making sure that there's no contact between them in violation of the solemn agreement that they had signed with great fanfare. And there's a reason for that. It's clear if you look at a map. The West Bank, whatever enclaves Israel might leave to Palestine within the West Bank, are themselves completely imprisoned. Israel's on one side, Jordan's on the other side, both allies of the United States, which is, you know, Israel's sponsor, basically. So they're imprisoned. Their only outlet to the world is through Gaza, seaport, airport, and so on. So separating Gaza from the West Bank is quite significant from the point of view of the goal of ensuring exactly what Dov Weissglass stated in the comments that I mentioned, which you can find documented over and over again in the Israeli literature. For example, the electoral program of the governing coalition in Israel, the Likud coalition, its electoral program states that there can never be a Palestinian state west of the Jordan, period. There's a lot of talk about the Hamas charter, which nobody takes seriously, but you won't find much about the electoral program of the governing coalition. That's been the commitment, no meaningful Palestinian state. So if we break Gaza from the West Bank, that means that whatever's left of the Palestinians in the West Bank will be imprisoned. And in fact, it's more extreme than that, because as part of Israel's settlement program that's been going on since the late 60s, they're systematically taking over the Jordan Valley, expelling Palestinians. This is about a third of the West Bank, some of the most valuable arable land. It's done by the usual method, establishing military zones where Palestinians aren't allowed to settle, and then Israeli military settlement moves in. Pretty soon it's a civilian settlement, sinking wells and expelling the population, standard measures. Happens slowly, so it doesn't receive much attention. Occasionally you'll get a report by the Israeli human rights group, B'Tselem, or by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, occasionally a newspaper report, but it's pretty much under the radar. And as that continues, the imprisonment of anything left to the Palestinians only increases. Hence the separation from Gaza has been quite a high priority. And it's been going on for 20 years in violation of the accords that were signed. Well, where does that leave us now, the latest ceasefire? One possibility, the most likely one, is that the pattern will continue again. But there is a possibility that it might not. And in fact, some knowledgeable Israeli commentators, one of the most interesting is Danny Rubenstein. He's a journalist formerly for Haaretz, before that for the Labor Party journal Davar, which is now gone, now an economic correspondent. He's written recently that he thinks that under current circumstances, the Netanyahu government might relax this requirement that Gaza be separated from the West Bank and might allow some development to take place in Gaza, contrary to the pattern of the past years. The reasons for this are not attractive. He doesn't give the reasons, but you can figure them out. One reason is that the Israeli takeover of lands in the West Bank has reached such a level that it may not matter much anymore if there's a connection to devastated Gaza. Another reason is the Egyptian military dictatorship. Israel now has a strong ally on the Egyptian side, a brutal military dictatorship, which is very anti-Palestinian. That increases the ability of Israel to permit a certain degree of development, maybe. Another is simply a change in the international environment. New alliances are forming all through the region. Saudi Arabia and Israel have always had a kind of a sub rosa tacit alliance, and now it's considerably more open with the shift. A complicated shift in alliances is taking place. There are even steps towards rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Iran because of the fear of the militant jihadi movements, the Islamic State, which were pretty much they're an outgrowth of the U.S. invasion of Iraq and have been funded and supported by wealthy Saudi Arabians, other Gulf Arabs. But by now, they're a real danger to the Saudi state and, of course, to Turkey and Iran, and odd alliances are now taking place. And it could be, as the Israeli government has stated, that in this new regional system, they are more capable of undertaking the programs, their own expansionist programs, without facing the limited hostility that they had before. Well, this conjuncture of various possibilities leads to various changes in the circumstances, does lead to a slight possibility, I think pretty slight, that the pattern won't be just reflexively repeated, as has been the case for the last 10 years. Now, I should say that the first steps are not very auspicious. As you know, the first major step that Israel took after the agreement was reached, the ceasefire agreement, was to expropriate about 1,000 acres of Palestinian land in the West Bank, biggest land expropriation in the past 30 years, expanding the illegal settlements. There's no question in anyone's mind that they're illegal, violation of international law, a violation of Security Council orders, world court decisions, and so on. And it's a pretty brazen step. And they apparently assume that President Obama is not going to say anything. You may recall that back in the early 70s, early 90s, when the Prime Minister, Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Shamir, did make some very brazen and insulting moves that deeply offended the Republican administration, the Bush one, this is the Bush-Baker administration. And they came down pretty hard on him, hard enough so that Israel had to throw the prime minister out and put in another prime minister. But they're apparently counting on the expectation that Obama won't do that. He'll just produce the nice formulas that the State Department has, in fact, produced about how this is unhelpful to peace. It's not nice. We wish you wouldn't do it. But no further reaction. And so far, that's been justified. We'll see if it continues. Well, suppose it does. What are the likely outcomes? What are the prospects for Palestinians? The discussion on all sides, Israel, Palestine, international commentators, almost all of it suggests that there are two options. One option is the two-state settlement, which has been an international consensus for decades. It's kind of doesn't get reported much here, but the first explicit formulation of it was in January 1976 when a resolution was brought to the Security Council by the three Arab so-called confrontation states, Egypt, Syria, and Jordan. The resolution called for a two-state settlement on the internationally recognized borders with recognition of the sovereignty and the right to exist in peace and security within secure and recognized borders for both Israel and a new Palestinian state. Israel was extremely angry. They didn't attend the session. The United States vetoed the resolution. Happened again in 1980. A U.S. veto is a double veto. First of all, nothing happens. And secondly, it's vetoed from history. So you find no reference to that. You have to search hard. It's there. You can find it, but pretty much gone. And that's been the story pretty much since. The most recent U.S. veto, which did receive a little attention because it was so unusual, it was in February 2011 when President Obama vetoed a resolution calling for implementation of official U.S. policy. That was kind of extreme, so there was a little notice in the press. The official policy is there shouldn't be any more settlement expansion. That's what's usually talked about, but it's worth bearing in mind it's a very minor issue. A settlement expansion is not the issue. It's the settlements that are the issue. Even expansion of settlements, opposition to that was vetoed by the Obama administration. They had various pretexts. You can read Susan Rice's comments on it, but that's been the steady pattern, and Israel's counting on it. But one possibility, then, is the two-state settlement, which is an overwhelming consensus. It includes the Arab League, the Organization of Islamic States, which includes Iran, Europe, Latin America, in fact, everybody, except the United States, Israel, and occasionally some Pacific island goes along. That's one option, two-state settlement with minor modifications that you can talk about. The other option, it's assumed almost universally, is that there will be one state west of the Jordan. And many Palestinians welcome that. They argue that if that's the case, the standard line is, okay, we'll hand the keys over to the Israelis. In fact, Abbas has stated it that way. And then we'll have a civil rights struggle, like the anti-apartheid struggle in South Africa. That will be better than both the present situation and a two-state alternative. Israelis comment on the same, also suggest that that's the second alternative, but they are worried about it because of something called the demographic problem, meaning too many Arabs in what's called a democratic Jewish state. So put that concept aside, but it's going to be pretty tricky to uphold it in Western eyes if you have a majority of Arabs. So there is the demographic problem. And that's the debate that's going on. The debate, in my opinion, is almost entirely beside the point because these are not the two options. The two options are, one, the international consensus, and two, continued implementation of the policies that Israel is carrying out before our eyes with full U.S. support. And that does not lead to Israeli takeover of Palestine. In fact, crucially, they do not want to take it over. It's quite different from South Africa. The analogy is really misleading. South Africa needed its black population. That was 85% of the population. It's their entire workforce. And South Africa, therefore, in a pretty awful way, kind of took care of them. The Bantustans were horrible enough, but South Africa developed them. They wanted them to be recognized by the outside world, and they had to preserve their workforce, make sure, that, first of all, that they were docile and then they were available for work. Israel wants nothing of the sort. It wants to get rid of the Palestinians. It doesn't want to have anything to do with them. They're not its workforce. They used to be years ago, but no longer. And they're just a nuisance. They're in the way. So the analogy to South Africa breaks down very quickly. In fact, what Israel's doing in the occupied territory should not be called apartheid, because it's much worse than apartheid, much worse, for exactly this reason. But if you take a look at the policies that the U.S. and Israel are carrying out, they are designed to exclude the Palestinian population in the West Bank. It's very clear what's happening. It's in front of your eyes. Israel's taking over, first of all, the vastly expanded region called Jerusalem, about five times as big as Jerusalem ever was. That's being taken over. Everything inside the so-called separation wall, illegal, of course, is being taken over. There are corridors extending to the east. One goes through from Greater Jerusalem. It goes almost to the borders of Jericho. The big town, Maale Adumim, built mostly in the Clinton years, is there. There's two others in the north going to the town of Ariel, town of Kedumim. They kind of cantonize what's left. Israel's taking over the Jordan Valley, but they're excluding the regions of Palestinian population concentration. They're not taking over Nablus. They don't want that. They want to leave the Palestinians alone, not to bring them into Greater Israel. The huge infrastructure projects, which are connecting West Bank settlements to Israel, so like you can travel from, say, Maale Adumim to Tel Aviv without ever seeing an Arab, and pretty quickly, they don't include Palestinians. And in fact, the limited Palestinian population in the regions that Israel's taking over are being systematically excluded. So the longer-term prospects for this policy are not a demographic problem, but rather actually an increase in the proportion of Jews, in the ratio of Jews, in the greater Israel that's being formed. That's what they're implementing. And there's every reason why they should try to continue as long as the U.S. supports them. That's much more favorable from the point of view of Israeli expansionists. That's a much more favorable solution than taking over the whole West Bank and facing the, what do you do with the majority, soon to be majority Palestinian population. That's what's before our eyes. In the areas that Israel's leaving to the Palestinians, a standard neocolonial arrangement is being established. This goes back to the 1990s. Back in the 1990s, Israeli industrialists pointed out to the government that it doesn't make sense to maintain a colonial control over the Palestinians. They should shift to a neocolonial control, which means that for Palestinian elites, there are islands of prosperity, freedom, development, and so on, around Ramallah, for example, where you have nightclubs and theaters and nice life for the elite. You find that in every third world country. Go to the poorest country in Central Africa, that's what you find. So that's the model that's being constructed. And with U.S. support, there's every reason to expect it to continue. And that's actually the crucial issue for us, particularly for everybody here. With U.S. support, any attempt to alleviate this must focus on the crucial fact that it cannot continue without decisive U.S. economic, military, diplomatic, and even ideological support, ideological in the way the issues are framed. And that's by no means fixed in, you know, graven in stone. That can be changed, and that's the weak point in the system, and we should be pleased about that, because that's the one element of the whole complex problem that we can hope to influence. You can't influence the others. You can influence this. And I think that's where energy and effort should be directed.
Professor Noam Chomsky, speaking at Indelis Cafe in Central Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts. This event was recorded by your radio announcer, Chuck Rosina, on Thursday, September 4th, 2014. After a short intermission, Professor Chomsky took questions from the audience, which can be heard in part 2 of this Gaza update.